I'm Judith Arcana. I live here in Portland. I have a lot of attachments to issues of reproductive justice, as well as two sort of different phrases, reproductive health and reproductive action. All of these are used sometimes as if they were interchangeable. They're not. Perhaps we'll talk about that. But I think about these things and their non-interchangeability, their politics, and the way they're played out on a daily basis. I have something of a history with this set of issues, coming to them quite young in terms of political action, thinking about them fairly early, and then in my late 20s, becoming a Jane, which is to say a member of the Chicago underground abortion group called The Service by Janes and called Jane by the rest of the world, I guess. So I'm a Jane. I've had an abortion. I think about what this stuff means in relation to motherhood. I've written several books about motherhood and about the relationships between making people and choosing not to make people on a long-term basis and in terms of individual decisions.
It would be good, I think, to just launch right into the difference between, or a little elaboration on those terms you were just talking about, reproductive health, reproductive justice, reproductive action.
When we use the term reproductive health, what we're talking about is literally the health of the organism that is about the job of human reproduction, the health of generally the woman's body. Sometimes folks are talking about the health of men's bodies. For instance, this is sort of a footnote to our current conversation, but the unfortunate health of sperm in the United States, generally speaking, there's less of it. It doesn't move as quick. It's not as healthy. But generally, we're talking about women's health when we talk about reproductive health. And the reason that it's more about women than men, of course, is that women make people inside of our bodies and then give birth to them. And so it's a bigger deal than just the production of sperm. So reproductive health has to do literally with how healthy a woman or girl is, has to do with whether she has the information and the resources to get healthy and to keep herself healthy so that if she does choose to make a person inside of her body, she will make a healthy one and she will go through the process in good health. When we talk about reproductive justice, we're talking about a much larger arena, I think. We're talking about all of the elements that bring women and men, boys and girls, to health, spiritually, emotionally, politically, physiologically, and to a situation of, what can I call it, a kind of liberated being, a conscious person in the world who can make with some clarity decisions about whether to reproduce or not, because the person has enough to eat, the person has a place to live, the person has an income in capitalist society so she can live. These things are required. This is part of the concept of justice when applied to reproduction, human reproduction, and the earlier term that I discussed, reproductive health. Generally, when folks talk about reproductive rights, they're speaking in a fairly narrow sphere. And I don't mean narrow in a negative sense. I mean just literally a more narrow sphere than when talking about human health or talking about justice. And that narrower sphere is rights in relation to laws and governance in relation to those laws. When we talk about rights, we talk about what are you allowed to do? What are you not allowed to do? And how do you feel about that comes in a separate package most of the time, partly because of the dearth of education and therefore the dearth of knowledge around human reproduction in the states. And partly because it's a tricky business. You know, we become physically capable of reproducing when we're quite young. And we're not always as smart as it would be useful to be making decisions about reproduction when we're 13 or 15. If we are boys and girls of 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, and we're getting into sex and we're dealing in heterosexual behavior, new people could result without the kind of knowledge and self-control that comes from knowledge and a wide sense of human being in the world, because we're just too young. I mean, old as I am, I can remember very clearly 13, 14, 15, and thinking, sex? Well, indeed. But not thinking, gee, well, okay, what if I make a person now, even before freshman year? Is that a good idea? And like that.
And what about reproductive action?
When you use a term like reproductive action, generally what you're talking about is political movement work that is necessary to deal with the society in which we find ourselves in the States these days, in the beginning of the 21st century, and indeed for the last few decades of the 20th, it was quite similar, and that is that action must be taken to deal with the need for knowledge, education, autonomy, and a general sense of ability on the part of individual women and girls to make decisions about whether to reproduce or not, so that we have marches, we have rallies, we have petitions, we have a lot of action around the laws that the anti-abortion movement is cleverly and frequently bringing to state legislatures around the nation, and certainly here in Oregon. We need to think of the action then as really overt, conscious, and deliberate political action in the interest of creating reproductive justice.
You've had a long history of action in the movement, and I guess in the larger framework of reproductive justice. What's happening right now politically?
The anti-abortion movement is tremendously powerful and has, as part of that power, a deep media base in the United States, as well as, of course, a lot of adherence in state legislatures and in federal government in all three arenas of the federal government. The anti-abortion movement has developed into a very powerful, efficient, well-oiled machine that spits out regularly proposals and legislative possibilities in every state, and that finances lobbying at the federal level. And that's been going on now ever since the mid to late 70s, just a few years after the Roe decision by the Supreme Court in 73. In 76, we had the Hyde Amendment, thanks to Henry Hyde of Illinois, which forbade federal payment for abortion care, so that women who are on welfare, women who are in the armed services, women who are in the Peace Corps, women who work for the post office, anybody who is getting their weekly or biweekly or monthly check for whatever reason, employment or disability, whatever it is, from the federal government cannot use the medical coverage for abortion services, for abortion health care. And that was a huge victory. And it came so soon after Roe that my view is that it caught the still happily triumphant pro-reproductive justice forces by surprise. And also the moral weight that those folks have given to their own work, the moral and ethical position that they have taken and that they claim as being that of the superior morality, aligning themselves with God, with the family, with maternity, as in mom and apple pie maternity, and acting as if anyone who doesn't agree with their particular position around childbearing and abortion issues is therefore immoral. That too worked like crazy. I mean, they have been very, very successful with that. The trend, as you asked, has been, you know, other cliches work, but this one will do for right now, all downhill since then for what I call the good guys, the home team. Partly in the beginning, it was being taken by surprise. But since then, it's a lot been, I think, about the tremendous amount of entree to both cash and media outlets that these folks have been able to take over. So that we have, for instance, the Murdoch Empire, Fox News, and many, many smaller outlets, and certainly on the net as well, many, many mouthpieces for that set of points of view. It's not just one. I mean, they disagree among themselves just like any other group of folks who are in a movement.
That was Judith Arcana. You'll hear more from her later in the show. Next up, we talk with Tony Bond Leonard here on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. You're listening to Circle A Radio.
I am Tony Bond Leonard, the president and CEO and co-founder of Black Women for Reproductive Justice, which is a reproductive justice organization based in Chicago, Illinois. And we have been around since 1996.
Can you tell us what is reproductive justice?
Reproductive justice is really about what does it take for Black women to be healthy, have healthy families, and live in healthy communities. What does it mean for Black women to have reproductive autonomy? And when we talk about the reproductive justice framework, it's really about supporting women to have access to the information and resources that they need if they are trying to prevent an unplanned pregnancy. So access to reproductive and sexual health information and education, things like understanding their menstrual cycle, understanding basic reproductive health information, understanding their bodies, and also access to comprehensive reproductive and sexual health education in the public schools. And then when you talk about women being able to have children, you know, they need the social and economic supports to be able to parent the children or child that they may have. And so that's what we're talking about when we talk about reproductive justice, and also understanding the intersectionality between issues of race, class, and gender, and how those issues have an impact upon women's ability to lead healthy reproductive lives. Black women have the least access to reproductive and sexual health education, including information about family planning and prevention and transmission of HIV, AIDS, and other sexually transmitted infections. So for Black women, it's not just about knowing how to control our fertility, but it's also looking at those issues where we have the largest health disparities. So we know that Black women have some of the highest rates of HIV and AIDS, and so certainly we need more information about prevention and transmission of HIV, AIDS, and other sexually transmitted infections. In Chicago, Illinois, for instance, we have extremely high rates of gonorrhea, chlamydia, and now syphilis within the Black community and amongst Black women. And so those are all issues that we need to begin to look at. And in terms of health, other health disparities, you know, as they relate to other health disparities, those are certainly issues that we need to be looking at as well. Black women continue to have disproportionately higher rates of infant mortality and morbidity. And so when you talk about the full range of reproductive health of Black women, it's not just about abortion, it's not just about access to family planning, but it's about all of those various reproductive health issues and general health issues that work together to prevent us from leading healthy lives.
And that's a really important background for our listeners to have when we're talking about the current struggle that brought Black women for reproductive justice to my attention, which is the racist anti-abortion billboards that are going up around the country, including in Chicago. So I'd love it if you could talk to our listeners about that campaign, who's behind it, and how are reproductive justice groups fighting back?
Well, the campaign first started in Atlanta, Georgia. And they were sponsored by a group called the Radiance Foundation. When they were in Atlanta, the slogan was, Black children were an endangered species, as if Black children are some sort of exotic animal. And groups in Atlanta like Sister Song and Sister Love and Spark for Reproductive Justice came together and waged a response to these billboards. At the same time, there was a piece of race and sex selection bill that was pending in the state legislature that would have criminalized physicians for performing abortions for women of Asian and Pacific Islander descent and also who were African American. And the groups in Atlanta were able to successfully prevent that legislation from being passed. So the billboards continued to move around the country, made a stop in Tennessee, saw some show up in Florida. Then they made their way to Milwaukee. When they went to Milwaukee, they still said black children were an endangered species. And then during Christmas, during the month of December and January and February, we saw some public service announcements show up on black entertainment television that was sponsored by a group called Heroic Media that said that the most dangerous place for an African American was the womb. As if black women, their bodies are set up to be this, black women's bodies are a dangerous place. So not only are we talking, not only are we trying to vilify black women for making the decision not to carry a pregnancy to term, we're also saying that black women's bodies are a dangerous place to care for a child to be. So, you know, it was a double indictment, if you will. Then the next place we saw the billboards were in California, and now they've made their way to Illinois. When they made their way to Chicago, Illinois, the theme of the billboard changed. So now the billboard says every 21 minutes a potential black leader is aborted with an image of President Obama on the billboard. What's so very heinous about this image is now they're saying or alleging that black women are murdering potential future black leaders. What makes this billboard particularly offensive and heinous is that they placed the first three billboards in the heart of the black community on the South Side, held a press conference with black faith-based leaders that they flew in, I think three of whom they flew in, and then they reached out to two more here in the local area. They held this press conference, gave their spiel, and said the only people they were going to take questions from were the media. They refused to take any questions from any of the black women who showed up to protest the billboards. And the black women here are furious, are just outraged, and just think that it is unconscionable that they would bring this billboard campaign here. They're planning to put up billboards in 29 more locations on the south and west sides of Chicago, areas that are populated predominantly by African Americans. So for us, for Black Women for Reproductive Justice, we understand what the real motive is behind this, and that this is part of their racist, anti-woman, homophobic agenda. It's a political agenda, and they want to carry out this agenda on the backs of black women. And I think what they're facing in Chicago is huge pushback, because black women are just not going
to
have it.
Can you tell us what you know about the push across the country to really fight back against this?
Absolutely. The group in New York that spearheaded efforts to have the billboards taken down was Sister Song New York, and they are serving as the New York anchor organization for New York, and that is ran by a woman named Jasmine Burnett, who also has the blog page Aunt Betty's Basement. And Jasmine, through Sister Song New York, was able to organize and mobilize a response from black women in New York, as well as with ally groups and supporters in New York, and pushed to have the billboard taken down. The other piece to why the billboard was taken down, the little girl whose image was on the billboard, her mother had taken her to a casting call for a modeling opportunity, and they took some photos of her, and those photos became stock pictures. And so that's how her picture ended up on the billboard. And when her mother saw her picture, she was, of course, furious, because she didn't know that's how her daughter's image was going to be used, and she didn't support her daughter's image being used in that way. So it was a combination of the mother's complaining and also of the outcry from the black community, from black women in New York, that helped to get the billboard down. And also through the response from public officials as well, who helped to get the billboard taken down.
Wow, that's appalling. I mean, the whole thing is really appalling, but it's inspiring to see the action and the leadership of groups like yours and Sister Song in getting these things taken down. How can people help? What can they do?
Well, I think certainly your listeners should contact Trust Black Women, and they can reach Trust Black Women by going to Sister Song website, which is sistersong.net, and clicking on the Trust Black Women initiative and finding out more information. Certainly there are change.org has an online petition that has been started in support of the work that we're doing here in Chicago, as well as taking a stand around billboards coming up across the country. I think, you know, the other thing that we need to do is we need to start getting the truth out about who these organizations are. So, for instance, in Chicago, the group that is behind the billboards is a group called Life Always. But Life Always is connected to another organization called Heroic Media. Heroic Media was behind the billboard in Soho in New York, and also was the group that was behind the public service announcements that were aired on BET. What's interesting to note about Heroic Media is that its founder, Brian Follett, was a huge financial supporter of the organization known as the Swift Voters, who came out during the time when former presidential candidate John Kerry was running and tried to discredit his Vietnam service record. What we have also found out about Heroic Media is that they have been doing fundraisers around the country in support of former presidential candidate Sarah Palin. They've also been in, Life Always has also been endorsed by the Tea Party. So, you know, it's important for your listeners to really know the truth about who these groups are and what their real motives are. When we posed the question during the press conference here when they came to Chicago on Tuesday, one of the things we asked them was, you know, why don't you all tell the truth about who you're really connected with? Why don't you all talk about the fact that Life Always is just another shell organization for Heroic Media, who has been going around the country raising money to support Sarah Palin? And why don't you all talk about your connections to the Tea Party? And why don't you all be forthcoming and honest? How dare you come here and put up a billboard that says, that charges, that vilifies black women and alleges that we are killing potential leaders of the black race, and then put a picture on the billboard, an image of President Barack Obama, and at the same time be sneakily raising money for Sarah Palin? How can you say that you care for black women? I think and care about black children. I think the other interesting thing that we found so very appalling was the fact that where they placed the billboard. The billboard is on a building that faces a vacant lot filled with all sorts of trash and broken glass and overgrown weeds and empty cartons and just all sorts of garbage. And it was more important for them to come in and hold this press conference and spew all of these lies about black women and what black women are doing to the black race and trying to throw you know, heinous allegations about black women's reproductive integrity and racial integrity than it was for them to take note of the fact that you're really going to do a press conference on a heap of trash, and then turn around and talk about how you support the lives of black children, really. And so then the fact that they thought nobody was going to pay attention to that was, I think, doubly offensive. I think for the African American community, the majority of African Americans are smart enough to know what the real political agenda is with respect to the Tea Party. It's an attack on many different fronts. It's not just an attack on women's right to reproductive autonomy, but they're also raising attacks on the LGBTQ community as well as they go around spewing their hate-filled messages about same-sex relationships and same-sex marriages because they're extremely, you know, anti-gay and homophobic. The other thing that I think your listeners need to know is that these are some of the same people who are against any sort of government safety net program and fought very hard against health care reform. And so, you know, how can you say that you want to save the lives of black children, yet you are against any sort of safety net program that will enable black women to take care of the children that they have? And also, these are some of the same groups who have waged a war on Title X funding, which women who are underinsured or have no insurance whatsoever, or women who are on Medicaid, rely upon to go for not just their family planning services, but for their annual pap smears, for their annual breast exams. How can you say that you really care about the health of people?
You're listening to an interview about reproductive justice on Circle A Radio.
If people want to find out more about what Black Women for Reproductive Justice is doing here in Chicago in relation to the billboards, please go visit our website at www.bwrj.org. And if folks would like to find out more about what is happening with the Trust Black Women campaign, please go visit the Sister Song website, which is www.sistersong.net.
Great. I thank you so much for sharing with us your knowledge and also taking the time, because I know it's been a very busy week. I've seen your name all over the news.
We are all over the place, and we're very tired, but we are committed to keeping up the fight, because the philosophy we hold at Black Women for Reproductive Justice is that we're not fighting this fight for faceless black women. We're fighting this fight for ourselves. This fight is about us, and it's important for black women to be out front, visible, having our voices be very loud and speaking to what the real issues are, and doing whatever we can to get these billboards to come down.
You just heard an interview with Toni Bond-Leonard, president of Black Women for Reproductive Justice. Next, we'll turn to a discussion of reproductive rights in Oregon and across the nation.
I'm Michelle Stranger Hunter, and I'm the executive director of NARAL Pro-Choice Oregon. NARAL has been in existence in Oregon since 1971. It's one of the oldest NARALs in the country, because Oregon is and has been a very pro-choice state. I also get to be the executive director of the Oregon Foundation for Reproductive Health. And the difference between those two organizations is that the foundation is our education work, our community education, public education work, and the NARAL Pro-Choice Oregon is the political work that we do to make sure that pro-choice legislators are elected, and then the kinds of policies and legislation that increases women's access to reproductive health care services is really protected and enhanced. NARAL, Pro-Choice Oregon, works with the legislature. We build a political constituency. We recruit volunteers and activists who support a woman's right to choose. And we work with them around organizing their friends and their communities and talking with legislators about what their needs are, what their reproductive health care needs are. And the other part of that is also protecting their reproductive rights. So that, for example, right now there is an anti-choice bill in the legislature, and we will be testifying in hopes of defeating that and not letting that piece move forward, because Oregon is one of only 6 states in the country that do not have any legal restrictions on a woman's access to the full range of reproductive options. So we've got a very special status, and we really want to protect that. The Oregon bills that are being proposed right now by the anti-choice legislators, one is would put a ban on abortion at 20 weeks, and there's no exception for rape and incest. It's only a very, very narrow exception around, you know, saving a woman's life, or if she's going to be maimed permanently if she were to have an abortion procedure. So it's extremely restrictive, and it, you know, whether it would even be constitutional is highly suspect. But the bottom line is it would take away Oregon women's right to access in those later weeks of pregnancy. And these are situations where it's the thing that has gone terribly wrong. These are heart-wrenching situations where if you're trying to draw a line as a politician or an elected person and say, no, you can't have this health procedure after so many weeks, it's like, you know what, can we just leave that to the personal, private decision between the woman and her doctor? I mean, it doesn't, in terms of reproductive health, it really doesn't get a whole lot more private and personal than that. And to think about legislators metaphorically inserting themselves in that relationship, you know, they don't have, frankly, they don't have the healthcare qualifications to be able to do that. What we want is we want physicians to be able to make decisions about the woman's health and her condition and the pregnancy, you know, without the interference of the legislators. There's another bill that would put heavier restrictions on centers that actually provide abortion procedures. And again, that's a piece of legislation that is very common across the country because they try to make it very, very hard for providers to actually do the procedure by, you know, creating as many barriers, expensive barriers and hoops that they have to jump through in hopes that it will deter them from continuing to offer the service. Bottom line is, abortion is health care. It's a part of our health. It's a medical procedure. And the fact that it always gets pulled out and dealt with so separately is really very detrimental in terms of the cost that it then has in women's lives, in their families' lives, and in the community.
A lot of us use Planned Parenthood for our pap smears or for getting birth control at a reasonable rate and all these things. So
yes.
Are the bills that we're seeing in Oregon also affecting other reproductive health rights?
No, not the Oregon legislation. Now, it's important to note, though, that if the funding is affected at the federal level, it would have to affect the Oregon services. You see what I mean? We don't have to have a separate piece of legislation that would do that. If it were to be passed in D.C., then there would be no family planning money for low-income women in Oregon, whether it's provided by a public health department or provided by Planned Parenthood. So we have to, even, you know, as a statewide organization, we have to be very concerned about what's happening at a federal level because it's also going to affect women right here and the services that they're able to attain.
Before we jump into more of the national level, can you talk about any current legislation that actually is attempting to strengthen the rights to abortion and reproductive health here in Oregon?
Let me respond to that by talking about Oregon health care reform, because there's great potential in Oregon healthcare reform. that the legislation as it has as it was passed in the 2009 legislative session, and as there's a healthcare transformation team that has been meeting, you know, over the course of the last 10 weeks, trying to make health reform a reality, that if that is passed with the amount of attention to primary care, so that women would have access to reproductive health through their primary care providers, so that, of course, they could still go to a family planning clinic, but they don't have to, that they could go to one physician who is going to ask them on a routine basis, do you plan to get pregnant this year? And if so, great, let's make sure you're healthy and you don't have any pre-existing conditions that are going to affect your pregnancy. And if no, great, what are you doing for contraception and are you satisfied with your method? So that pregnancy becomes planned and healthier, and we can reduce the costs in terms of women's lives as well as, you know, the healthcare costs that are related to unintended pregnancies, which are enormous. So healthcare reform, I think, holds great promise for increasing women's access to reproductive health care services across the state.
Now, do you want to talk about the national issues that are affecting the reproductive rights movement?
Wish that I didn't have to talk about these. It's amazing to me that a group of candidates that got elected based on limited government and economy and growing jobs, but mainly limited government, that they then turn around and they want to regulate women's bodies. There have been some just incredible anti-choice bills that have been put forth and promoted in D.C. And on top of that, on top of trying to restrict access, a woman's access to abortion in those cases where this is really a pregnancy that she feels she cannot continue, in addition to that, they're going to take away our family planning money so that we're going to make it even more likely that women have unintended pregnancies. I mean, this is counterintuitive. It just isn't common sense, never mind any kind of compassionate sense. The fact that there is this kind of legislation that's happening on a federal level is it's disastrous across the country because it's really encouraging all kinds of bad bills in, you know, all of the states as well. There's been like 700 different pieces of legislation, anti-choice legislation, that's been put forward in state legislatures across the country, which is more than 60% of all the bills. What is there about this issue where, you know, it's the place to land, it's the safe place for conservatives to land, that they can whip up their base and get people excited about it, and it always comes out of, you know, it comes out of women's health. They're trying to eliminate Title X family planning. They're trying to eliminate funding for Planned Parenthood. Both enable low-income women to access contraceptive services. Tell me why on earth you would not want women to have access to contraceptive services that want them and need them so that they can be planful about their pregnancies. I have been at this for 40 years. And I cannot believe that we are where we are today, 40 years later. We have definitely gone backward.
With being involved in the struggle for 40 years, can you talk about a brief history of the last 40 years of the struggle for reproductive rights?
Sure, because I was working in Massachusetts, and we had to refer women to New York. They could not get a legal abortion in Massachusetts. I was there in the beginning when women were dying. Women were dying because the bottom line is restrictions do not stop women from seeking abortion. I've never met a woman who wanted to need an abortion. And restrictions don't do anything. They just cause her to do something that is not safe, that is not healthy, because she will find a way. I've seen it when the full range of reproductive options were really honored, and they were offered to women, and we watched as the unintended pregnancy rate came down. The teenage pregnancy rate came down. And the abortion rate has come down because we had increased access to contraception. And to turn around and try to put those additional restrictions on top of it has really taken us back. And I'll give you a prime example. In 2000, when President Bush became president, the very first day, he reenacted the gag rule, which meant family planning monies going overseas could no longer go to any place that was also even referring for abortion. President Bush transferred significant portions of family planning money into abstinence-only sex education. As a result, we have a population of 18 to 29-year-olds who are woefully ignorant when it comes to how their reproductive system works. And what I can tell you is that in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, people were a lot more educated about their risk of pregnancy and what to do to prevent that pregnancy than they are in 2011. And how sad is that? Because it's ignorance that is, you know, causing this increase in unintended pregnancies. And we're watching, you know, teen pregnancies go up. And unfortunately, I'm afraid for the first time in 20 years, we're going to see the abortion rate go up as well. Restrictions don't do what the opponents say they're trying to do. It just isn't the way it works. The country, France, has the greatest access to contraception on the planet, and they have the lowest abortion rate on the planet. You know, it's like 4%. So if we could simply learn that restrictions are not the answer, education, information, and access is what will enable women to do the right thing, to make those responsible decisions and plan their families.
If we want to know how our listeners can get involved in the struggle for reproductive rights and any websites or resources.
Thank you so much. Please, we need every person who has any interest in supporting women's reproductive rights and services and access to services. Go to our website, www.prochoiceoregon.org, or email Maeve, M-A-E-V-E, at prochoiceoregon.org. We have so many different volunteer opportunities and ways to get you involved. And frankly, if you just go to our website and sign up, that way you can get our emails and you will stay in touch on a daily, when necessary, but at least weekly basis of exactly what's happening in D.C. and happening here in Oregon that is affecting this and what you can do about that particular thing right in the moment.
That was Michelle Stranger Hunter, Executive Director of NARAL Pro-Choice Oregon. You're listening to a program about reproductive rights, health, and justice here on Circle A Radio. We return to our interview with Judith Arcana.
Some of the new legislation that's been coming up in the past year or two has been really gnarly. And so maybe we want to talk about some of those and what they actually mean, and some that have passed and some that haven't, and
sure,
kind of get.
Okay. Well, some of the folks who are listening on the radio, we were actually talking about this in the studio earlier. Some of the states in the U.S. Have, over the last X number of years, passed laws that do things like this. I'm just going to read a couple examples and then we can talk about them. There are 38 states. This is as of spring of last year in 2010. There are 38 states that prohibit abortion except when necessary to protect a woman's life or health. Now, you may say to yourself, but wait a minute. What about Roe? Federal law. Well, that's what about Roe? It's been so eviscerated that state legislatures are taking these actions, getting these resolutions passed. There are 34 states that require parental notification for minors seeking abortions. And that's the kind of thing where you might think, oh, well, they're kids. Of course they should ask mom and dad. But there are so many reasons, so many exceptions that ask a 15-year-old girl can come into play here that can be stultifying. For example, one of the more horrific examples is when dad is the father of the fetus. When mom and dad have not been responsible parents to the young woman, practically a child, who is at present pregnant. Those are the two most outrageous. Unfortunately, they're not the two most uncommon. Here's another one. 46 states allow health care providers to refuse abortion service. Now, again, you may think, well, how many are there? Well, in this climate that we've been discussing, there are actually many. And it isn't that they are that they personally find abortion distasteful, although some do, but very often it's because, and who can blame them, they're afraid. They don't want all those picketers in front of their clinics. They don't care to have their children harassed on the playground at school. They're not interested in being assassinated in their own homes or, as in the case of Dr. Tiller, in church. So that cuts down on the number of people who are willing to be abortion providers, especially in light of this kind of legislation. There are 17 states that mandate that women be given what is called, and I say, quote unquote, counseling before they can have an abortion. And generally what that means is a kind of argument against, often with pictures of fetuses, couched in language that, again, it's that fallback position I was talking about before. Of course, you won't have an abortion unless there's some really dire situation that would force you to do this terrible thing. And this is called, quote unquote, counseling. There are 24 states that have mandatory waiting periods. And again, you might say to yourself, well, this is such a serious decision. Of course, you should wait a bit. You should turn it over in your mind. But think about this. This is truly a case where we're not talking TV here. The clock is ticking. And that the more pregnant the woman is, the further along the fetus is in development, the more difficult, the more painful, the more expensive, and of course, the harder to obtain the abortion process is. So a waiting period is truly a stalling action on the part of the anti-abortion movement instituted for that reason. The last one that I've got in my notes, and y'all might have something more or different, is that 16 states have passed laws banning abortions after the first trimester. Now, we're not talking 6 months here. We're talking the first trimester, and they will define it, of course, very narrowly. 12 weeks, that's it, at the end of 12 weeks. Now, of course, what's really interesting here is that you don't really know because the time that you're starting from is date of the last menstrual period. Well, did she get pregnant during her period? Did she get pregnant right after her period? Did she get pregnant 2 weeks after her period? That makes a tremendous difference in terms of fetal growth and the changes in her body. After the first trimester is extremely severe, and the big push that the anti-abortion movement made with this and the way they were very successful was creating the concept of what they called, this is a name they made up, the partial birth abortion. And of course, that sounds terrible, which it would be if it actually existed, I suppose. It's not a medical term. It's not even a medical procedure. It's literally a made-up thing to frighten people. And also, and this is really important, back to that moral and ethical position again, to horrify people and to make women feel shame and guilt so that they would never do such a thing. So those are some of the very specific legislative actions that states have taken in the United States and that have, of course, consistently been pushed on the federal level as well. At the same time, you know, these people are not dumb. This business of running on parallel tracks. You work in the states, you work at the federal level, and at the federal level, you work both in Congress, in the House and the Senate, and also with the court and the president. do I say with the court? In this case, given our court, I would say with the court. In the case of the president, I suppose it depends who's up to bat. We haven't been too lucky in the last, 20 years in terms of presidents being on the good guys team. So they have all of these different parallel lines running. And at the same time, they're very aware whether they get Roe overturned or not. And it's likely, of course, that they will, given the constituency of the court. They have eviscerated it so that all that's left is this sort of lonely fact at the top of a very, very skinny toothpick arrangement. The fact is, it's legal. But what's under that, that skinny toothpick, is, but try to get it. Try to find it, especially if you don't live in a big city, if you don't have cash to spare, if you don't know too much about the situation, and if you don't have support, people who care about you and will help you get where you need to go and get what you need to get. And that's a whole lot of women and girls that I just described in that set. Here in Oregon, our fund is the Network for Reproductive Options. Their office is in Eugene, but they operate all over the state. And in fact, in terms of emergencies, NRO, as it's called, the Network for Reproductive Options, has helped women from the part of Washington that's near our borders and parts of Idaho and maybe even people from Northern California as well. There is a national network called, appropriately enough, the National Network of Abortion Funds, and NRO is our local. And it's enormously important that people, first of all, know that it exists, and second of all, that they know that NRO is always in struggle to get the cash that's needed to help women who don't have enough money to pay for the abortion and this is almost always required, to pay for, let's say, child care. If the woman's got a couple kids, she can't just leave wherever, I don't know, La Grande, let's say, or John Day, or Klamath Falls. If you don't live in Portland, Eugene, Ashland, or Bend, then you've got to travel in Oregon. And Oregon is not, you know, Delaware. There's a lot of miles to cover. And so women have to travel. They need money and time for that. They probably, in easily 50% of the cases, will need some kind of child care or assistance, and it might be paid for. They might have to leave their jobs if they're going to be gone for more than 24 hours, and odds are they will, and so on and so on. Plus, of course, the cost of abortion has gone up a lot too much because of the need for insurance on the part of abortion providers and other sort of amalgamated costs that have punched up what should be a relatively inexpensive and actually is a relatively simple procedure. It's now become this really big thing because of the effect of the anti-abortion movement. As every year, fundraising is going on year-round. We are just coming to, however, the bowl-a-thon, where we are bowling to strike down abortion prohibitions. And people like me, who are not, shall we say, the best bowlers on the planet, are going to show up at the bowling alley here in Portland and bowl with you all sending money to back us up.
On Facebook, search for Network for Reproductive Options or National Network of Abortion Funds, and you'll find links to support the bowlers. We'll also have a link on our webpage at kboo.fm/circlearadio. The bowl-a-thon takes place this weekend, so don't delay.
Sometimes folks in Oregon become complacent because, relatively speaking, we've been fairly lucky in terms of abortion law. Statewide, we have been able to defeat the measures that the anti-abortion movement has brought forward, stuff about parental consent, stuff about waiting periods, you know, all the various things that have been applied in many other states have not been able to be applied in Oregon. But of course, they're not giving up. They're not coming off it. And the current push is House Bill 3512. What they're calling it has very little to do with its purpose and how it might actually work. They're calling it the Unborn Infant Pain Relief Act. And the idea is that women in Oregon should not be able to abort after week 20. And again, you may say to yourself, well, why would anybody want to? Well, nobody wants to. The answer to that is nobody would want to. But then what you have to realize is that sometimes it's necessary. Sometimes it is tragically and miserably and painfully necessary for a whole bunch of different reasons. The woman's health, possibly even the health and construction of the fetus itself. The fact that she didn't know she was pregnant for a long time, or possibly the fact that she's 12 years old, or there are many reasons that a woman would or girl would come to that point and need an abortion that late in pregnancy. Now, the fact that there are many reasons, though, doesn't mean that it happens many times. It's actually a very tiny percentage of abortions that get done that late. And that's the wedge that the anti-abortion movement uses. They come in, it's like their partial birth abortion thing. They create a flurry about something that sounds terrifying and grim, given their description. And in this case, it's about how the procedure is literally killing a baby in utero if you're past 20 weeks. Now, one thing that the audience that's listening to us on this show needs to think about and know, and again, you can find a whole lot of information about this on the net. There's been for a long time big fights in the science community and in the medical community, and where they overlap, of course, it's the fiercest, about fetal pain. What is it? Is there such a thing? Does the fetus feel pain? Can it feel pain? At what point does it feel pain? Now, the folks who have created, and there is no answer yet. I say yet because that's the way they say it. Myself, I don't know that there ever will be. But the anti-abortion movement has obviously come down on the side that the fetus does feel pain, and very early, and even earlier than 20 weeks is a terrible, painful thing. But certainly after 20 weeks, they are saying, is even more destructive and immoral and even more horrifying and a more terrible cause of shame and guilt for the woman or girl. Not only is she committing murder, but she's doing it in this horrific way. So that's how they're couching it. And that's the next one that they're bringing to us, to the State House and to the governor here in Oregon. So it's terribly important that people be informed, that y'all find out about this, and that you support the folks who will be fighting against this. My personal analysis involves the following. I believe that just like at the federal level, and as has been done in other states, the anti-abortion movement will use this as a bargaining chip against single-payer health insurance in Oregon. And there is a groundswell, I think, it may not be huge yet, for single-payer health insurance in Oregon. I think we have a shot at it. Maybe not a great shot in these bad health care times, but a shot. Okay. And I think that they might hold off, you know how this works, folks, and say, okay, we'll give you single-payer if you will not pay for abortions past 20 weeks, or, as of course they've done in other places, abortions at all. Somewhere between those two will certainly be part of the arguing, the bargaining, what goes on across those tables in Salem and elsewhere in the state. So this particular thing, House Bill 3512, is important for us, and we need to be sure that it doesn't get anywhere. Go to my website, juditharcana.com. There's a lot of clickable links on that site, including to other KBOO shows and books and articles and movies and essays and op-eds and so on. Stuff online, stuff in film world, that's pretty useful.
Thanks to our guests, Judith Arcana, Tony Bond Leonard, and Michelle Stranger Hunter. To hear this show again or listen to past shows, go to kboo.fm/CircleA Radio. Circle A Radio airs every first and third Wednesday of the month on KBOO Community Radio. Thanks for listening.